This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 274, was recorded on June 3rd, 2021. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Masterworks.io, bringing fine art investing within reach of all investors. Natural resource investing guru Marin Katusa returns as this week's feature interview guest. We're going to focus this week's interview specifically on the private equity deals that are only offered to accredited investors, allowing them to buy precious metals mining stocks directly from the issuing company off the listed exchange and often at a discount to the price everyone else is paying for the same shares on the open market. We'll discuss private placements and financing in gold mining stocks, as well as other speculative natural resource investments, such as uranium and even carbon credits. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when we'll be talking charts with Patrick.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's get to the S&P 500. We started the day with a quick little drop, but we're back to 4,200. Like, these buy-on dips just keep coming right back into the market. I want to talk about with some charts, but what's your take on all of this?
Well, Patrick, the froth continues. We're still above all of the short-term moving averages. As much as I agree with the overvalued arguments, I wouldn't want to be short here. Glad I'm not long either and happy to be trading oil instead.
All right, well, let's move on to the dollar index, because it suddenly has come back to life. I mean, after almost 2 weeks of trading in that like a 50-cent range between 89.5 and 90, we finally have a pretty decisive breakout on the upside. Do you think this is a legitimate turn in the dollar?
Well, maybe in the very short term, there's been a change of direction to the upside in the last couple of days, Patrick. But, you know, big picture, I think everybody is just getting wound up about what really is a pretty boring consolidation pattern. We're consolidating sideways until we get a breakdown below 89 or a really decisive break upwards, substantially higher. It's a little easier to say there's a clear line in the sand on the downside at 89. I'm not sure exactly what the line in the sand is on the upside. But frankly, I think this is a situation where the market really, you know, it's digesting a new presidency. If you look at the chart, what's going on is ever since the election, there's a broadening pattern. That means the market is exploring uncertainty, unsure what the Biden presidency means. We'll figure it out and we'll see where we go. But for now, we're just chugging along, consolidating.
Well, Eric, the one market that isn't stuck in a trade range is crude oil, which broke out to a fresh 52-week highs. What's your take on the oil market and how did inventory numbers come in?
Well, very consistent with my expectations and the prognostications I've talked about here on Macro Voices for the last few weeks, there has been a breakout, and I believe that the second major leg of the epic 2021 crude oil bull market has begun. Now, Patrick, you're the technician in the house, but if I apply my most simplistic measured move analysis, I get a target potentially as high as $92 on front month WTI as far as where this could go. My previous estimate had been at least 80. So I think my new outlook is a high price on WTI for the year, peaking somewhere between $80 and $92 by Labor Day. And frankly, it's very possibly on the way to $150 by the end of 2022. But that scenario would require quite a few more dominoes to fall into line and line up exactly the right way. So I'm not so sure about that one. But I think we're headed to $80 to $90 oil before the summer is over. As far as inventory is concerned, we had another big drawdown on crude oil this week, 5.1 million barrels, another 500,000 barrels coming out of the SPR for 5.7 total. Cushing, Oklahoma, building 748,000 barrels. But the builds that really counted this week were on finished products. Gasoline building 1.5 million barrels and distillates with a massive 3.7 million barrel build. U.S. production ticking down a couple of ticks to 10.8 million barrels. from 11 million barrels previously. One tick is not a trend, but we'll be watching it to see if we get that expected slowdown in production later this year.
All right, well, let's touch on gold, because gold for 2 months has been up almost every week. And today we come into recording this with one of the biggest gold down days we've had in several months, even though $36 isn't necessarily that big of a move. But do you think some sort of a gold correction may be underway here, or is this just going to be bought on dip and the trend continues?
Well, Patrick, as I explained in last week's show, this is good news and very much expected. What I said last week is the chart looks fantastic longer term, but the thing is, we just broke through that 200-day moving average, and you know as well as I do that a very common pattern when you break through a major level is that you end up going back down and retesting it as support. That's what happened this morning, is gold went back down, didn't get quite to the 200-day moving average at 1854, got down to about the 21-day moving average, which is at 1863, maybe just a little bit above it. Maybe it's got a little bit more to go down, and of course, you know, you never know. Maybe Treasury rates are going to run away to the upside, and we're going down to $1,200 gold. I don't know. But Patrick, the point is, the most likely outcome in this scenario is that we're retesting the 200-day moving average as support, and this is a buy right now. The final confirmation will be when we move higher to new highs beyond that recent high of 1910 or whatever it was just a few days ago.
All right, well, let's touch on the 10-year Treasury yield, because this week might have been the tightest one-week range of the yields that at least that I remember. I mean, we haven't seemed to move off this 1.62 level. What's your take on Treasury bonds?
Well, the fact that you're seeing less volatility tells me that there's less panic. I think there were a lot of people who were kind of freaking out about bond yields backing up and not sure what they were going to do in terms of repositioning if they did. I think that those people that were panicking are at least calming down. Now, whether or not they should be calming down, I'm not so sure. But I think that the panic that rates are about to run away has kind of come out of the system, and that's resulted in less volatility in Treasury yields. You remember back in the old days, Treasury yields used to be very boring. You know, they didn't change other than once every couple days or so. Needless to say, those days are long gone.
This week's feature interview guest is Marin Katusa. Now, Eric, why did we invite Marin back on the show this week?
Well, we had a listener question a few weeks ago saying, why don't I reveal the names of the stocks that I'm buying when I buy gold mining shares? And I explained the answer is most of them come out of recommendations from Marin's newsletter service, and out of respect for his other paying subscribers, I can't really be telling you what they are on the air. Somebody wrote back and said, well, if you're not going to tell us in the air, why don't you get Marin on the air to talk to us about this? And what we decided to do, Patrick, is a repeat of something we first did with Rick Rules several years ago, which was to do an interview explaining for the benefit of those accredited investors who may not realize that there are special deals where you can sometimes buy stock at a discount price, at a better price than what it's being offered on the public markets, if you buy it directly from the company in a deal that only accredited investors are eligible for. There's a lot of accredited investors who are eligible for those deals and don't know that they're there or how to find them or what exists. Now, what I'd originally intended was to kind of cover the landscape of the industry and how this works and so forth. Marin is a natural-born salesman and a good one, so he ended up talking quite a bit about his service as opposed to the industry on whole. But in addition to what Marin does, you know, there's a whole industry of capital introduction brokers that hook accredited investors up with opportunities only offered to accredited investors. So I wanted to just cover that subject matter because I certainly think, as an accredited investor myself, that's where the opportunities are in the gold market, is to buy the mining shares at a discount to what they're trading for in the public markets.
Eric's interview with Marin is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Abaxx Technologies. In addition to sponsoring Macro Voices, Abaxx also produces Smarter Markets, a weekly podcast that airs every Saturday morning on all the major podcast platforms. Smarter Markets brings together the leading minds in macroeconomics, technology, and commodities to explore how capital markets can be redesigned to better serve market participants and society as a whole. Michelle Dennedy's interview with Greg Lavender, Chief Technology Officer at VMware and former Managing Director of Cloud Architecture at Citigroup, airs this morning. And you can look forward to another terrific interview every weekend on Smarter Markets. But you won't get Smarter Markets on your Macro Voices feed. You have to subscribe separately to Smarter Markets in your podcast app to listen to this free new podcast.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Katusa Research founder Marin Katusa. Marin, it's great to have you back on the show. I know that you've got a brand new book out, which just hit the number one bestseller list on Amazon. I want to talk to you about that before this interview is over. But what I really want to dive into, because people have asked for it, is to talk about the options that exist for accredited investors in the gold market, precious metals market, and let's expand that to natural resources generally, uranium and other kinds of mining, where those opportunities exist. Because what I do when I'm buying gold is I do it in the futures market if I want the bullion. And if I want the mining shares, frankly, and I want to make sure that we're fully disclosing this to our listeners, we do have a business relationship. What I do when I buy the mining shares is I am a subscriber to your newsletter, and I participate in a lot of your recommendations. You do recommend buying stock on the open market, and I've done that on your recommendation from time to time. But mostly what I've participated in is special opportunities that are only offered to accredited investors. So I want to educate anyone who is accredited but might not understand what the options are about the marketplace and talk about what's possible. So give us the background on this market. Why accredited investors? Why is the deal different for accredited investors? And why does this industry in particular seem to do so many financings that are offered only to accredited investors?
Thanks, Eric. Let's go back when I started out about 20 years ago. You know, I knew nobody in the business. You know, I grew up in East Vancouver, and by total fluke, Vancouver is the epicenter for resource and commodity capital. It's where things get financed. And that goes back almost 100 years. Why? But when I started out, it was right at the beginning of the big, you know, BRICS growth, China growth, the commodity bull market. Gold started at $350 an ounce. And, you know, you go through the CFA program and they don't even talk about private placements or warrants. And I'm sitting there, you know, at these investment conferences and listening to the big players at the time. And they would talk about, you know, just passively, oh, yeah, you know, I did that financing at 25 cents, stock went to $5, I blew out the shares, and, you know, I ride the warrants. And I was like, what the hell are they talking about? You know, I was just a young kid at the time and going, well, when I go on to E-Trade, I don't get any access to this. How do I participate in these financings that the biggest names in the business are doing? So as I built my way up, walked up the ladder in the industry little by little, in about 2005, I started going, wait a second, this is crazy what's going on. And it really made sense from the outside. But you have a geologist who's got zero business sense, zero business experience. And because of the nature of the beast, the geologists were asked to be presidents and CEOs and chairmen of these companies. And then, you know, more of the advanced mining companies, it was the engineers. And geology and engineers, they don't take business courses. And generally speaking, most of them don't have business experience. So what happened was these stockbrokers who would rotate from, you know, selling bags of shit to used cars to whatever it was to make a finder's fee and a transaction fee, jumped on this trend where a lot of brokerage firms would jump onto these companies and they were paying 10% cash, 10% broker warrants. So think about this, Eric. You know, a company raises $10 million to go raise money. $1 million of that goes to the investment bankers, and then they get $1 million warrants on top of that. And because it was a bull market, that's just the way it was. So I was the first guy that said, wait a second, these investment bankers are not that sharp. These brokers are morons. Like, they literally couldn't pass a grade 10 algebra exam, but they're dictating terms on these things. So I got involved in building companies early on, you know, Copper Mountain, which became Canada's third largest mining company for copper production, Quadrilla, which became Europe's largest shale gas company. And I was involved, wait a second, we're not going to do it that way. And so I became persona non grata in the finance world with these brokerage firms. It got so bad, Eric, that I was not invited to investment firms' research days where they would host companies where my companies were the biggest companies at the show. Think about that, right? And my advantage was this. You know, I teamed up early with a guy named Doug Casey, and Doug made his score and he asked me to manage his money. And I said, well, you know, if I bring in the subscribers in at the same time and at the same price, plus my personal capital, plus Doug Casey's capital, I can compete with these big banks. And that's what started happening. So in lieu of finder fees, because I don't take any finder fees, I said, I want warrants. And then we created the CATUSA warrant, which is the 5-year listed tradable warrant. And it was a way for my subscribers to get involved, and it became a smashing success. We've raised billions of dollars doing this. Some of the biggest companies in the gold market like Equinox and the big energy companies like Altera, we've all used this mechanism like the CATUSA financing, where my subscribers and I and yourself all participate at the same time, at the same price. And there's no finder fees paid to anybody, but we get these juicy warrants that list and trade. So that's kind of where it came about. And the reason why it became for accredited goes back to actually the 1929, in the 1930s, they brought in a securities rule act that, you know, people got fleeced in America. And at the bottom of the Great Depression, they brought these rules that you had to be accredited. So generally speaking, not always do you have to be accredited, but generally speaking, if you're a American, you have to be accredited. And if you're a non-American, meaning European, Asia, Canada, Australia, you can be accredited and get in. And in some cases, most cases, if you're a Canadian non-accredited, you can get in if the companies file the right paperwork. But why did the brokerage firms not do this? Well, because the big secret of the mining sector is there's like 20 funds that are 90% of the pool of capital. So these investment bankers want to take the best deals to their main guys. And investment bankers don't want 1,000 subscribers. They want 10. They want to have 10 meetings to get their $1 million finder fee, not 1,000 phone calls. And that's the big difference between what I'm doing and the bankers. And the biggest difference, Eric, is on a deal that I'm doing. I'll put up, so for example, right now that we're doing an IPO on, I did my numbers. I was there. Everyone had the data set. I did my homework a bit faster than the other bankers. And I said, I'll tell you what, these are the terms that I'm willing to do. I will personally commit to a $10 million check, but I want my subscribers to have this much. If they choose, it could be zero, it could be 50 million, but they get in at the same terms and price, and there's no fees paid to anybody. But I want these terms, and the terms come with a CATUSA warrant. And that's how I'm able to structure these deals. So I'm usually, most cases, the largest investor in these deals. And in the business, Eric, a lot of the times the company have no idea what the company will be financed at because it's at the mercy of the market. So the bankers will do a roadshow. The funds who are in there are going to manipulate the stock. They're going to short the stock. And until the night before the book is done, the company has no idea what price it's going to be. So if you're a shareholder and you see that, you know, you have to understand what's going on. That's another advantage that the companies know. I don't do that because I put out to my subscribers that they can sell first before I do. And there's no games being played. I'm going for the big score. And if any one of your viewers look at any one of the deals that we've talked about, that we've presented opportunities, you're not sitting at, you know, 50% gains. The uranium deal that we did, the IPO, you're up over 400%. The one from a year ago, you're up over 500%. And the gold markets and the uranium markets haven't been that great. And if you play this right and you know how to do it, there's no better way to invest than in private placements and financings, right? That's a strategic way to do it. It's not the only way to play it, but that's generally my strategic advantage in this market, and it's how I go about investing big sums of money in the sector.
I want to stop you right there, Marin, because first of all, I agree with you emphatically, but I think we really need to clarify financings and private placements, what that terminology means in the context of precious metals mining shares versus what it means in, let's say, the software industry is completely completely, totally different. So I think we need to clarify and I think explain how this works in the precious metals business for people whose knowledge is in other markets. Because, you know, in the software market, the way this works is there's angel investors are the only opportunity really for accredited individuals to play in the software capitalization game. And they become angel investors. So accredited investors become angel investors in startup companies, but then the rest of the capital formation process is usually managed by venture capital firms that do the rest of it until you get to the IPO point. In the precious metal space, it doesn't work that way. You don't really have precious metals venture capital firms, as far as I know. The way it works is that there are various offerings that are made only to accredited investors, that it's not really the same thing as a private placement in the most strict definition of that term. Because when I think private placement, I'm thinking angel investment. It's a brand new company. A lot of the deals that I've done with you, Maren, it's a company that's already trading on a stock exchange. It's not a private company, it's a public company, but you're buying shares on the private market from the public company, which frankly is something that doesn't normally happen in most markets. So give us a little bit more of an understanding of how all of this works and what the role is that accredited investors play in the capital formation process, who they're buying from and who they're selling to in the end.
Great question. So the last large transaction, see, I don't do many deals either, Eric. Like I'll do maybe two or three of these a year, but they're big checks and takes a long time to do the due diligence and meet the criteria. The last big financing we did was on the New York Stock Exchange. That's a big board. It was trading and you did not have to be accredited because the company filled out the proper forms. They were organized. They were guys that understood the market and all the stock was free trading and the warrants, and you did not have to be accredited in the US or non-US. So it's not always accredited. You know, every deal is specific. Secondly, the reason why it's called private placement, it sounds like it's a placement or a financing in a private company. The reason why the lawyers in the industry of mining call it that, it was a transaction between the company and specific investors that were not available to the public market, meaning not everybody in the stock market had access to it. But think about the insanity of this. Sometimes these are trading at doubles and triples in the open market, Eric, because the company and the bankers do something called price protection. One financing that we're doing, it's trading four times higher in the market than what me, you, my subscribers can pay with the warrant because it was price protected. And it's a private transaction. It's called a private placement because that's not everybody can get access to it. It comes down to, are you directly investing in the company? So the company issues the shares. They give you the shares after you give them their money. They'll give you a certificate that has shares and warrants. And everything I do has warrants. Not always do the bankers have warrants. And then you take that and usually, not always, but usually there's a 4-month hold or a restriction of selling your paper. And that's why it's called a private placement. But almost everything I do is always publicly listed on a big board stock exchange that you can go on your phone or on your desktop or laptop, log in and see what it's trading at, you know, during market hours. IPO, initial public offerings, same thing. Then there's something called a short form versus a long form. A short form is when the company fills out the proper documentation to have no restricted paper. So it all comes down to, you know, what stage is the company, who's leading the financing, and what terms are they dictating. There are certain funds out there that think warrants are stupid. Okay, that's their prerogative. I think that logic is stupid. If I can make 5 times my money, but with a warrant, I can make 8 times. I think you have to be stupid to think that 8 times is not better than 5 times. But the reason why they want to do that is they want to price out other competitors who want warrants, right? So it's all about competition and everyone's competing to put, you know, get into the deals. And what I have found, Eric, is when gold is hot and all the bankers are flying around on private planes and geologists are being wined and dined at fancy dinners, that's when I shy away from the business and go do something else. You don't want to compete with the bankers. Why? They're not putting up any money. The brokers aren't putting up any money, Remember, they're using your money and they're going to take whatever terms they can to get the deal done. They get paid cash and they get paid broker units, meaning they get stock for not paying for it in lieu of fees. And sometimes it works out to be like 15, 20% warrants. So my good friends in the business have made an incredible career doing this. Guys like Rick Rule and the Sprott Group and all these private brokerages, Goldman Sachs. How do you think they make so much money without putting up the capital? And all I'm trying to do is say, I'm going to disrupt this industry and I just want better terms. And the company doesn't have to pay finder fees. They don't have to pay broker warrants. They get the money. They get a guaranteed lead order from me. And yeah, am I an alligator and want the best deal possible? Of course. It's my money. I'm allowed to do whatever the hell I want with my money. I'm always going to get
Hang on, Varun. I'm going to interrupt you there because I do want to get to the details of how you structure your deals. But I want to start by just introducing our audience to how this market works and how people gain access to it. Because frankly, Varun, most normal, reasonable people would assume that if you look at E-Trade or whatever and you say, what's the price of a gold stock like Equinox, very well-known stock, I think EQX is the ticker. It shows you the price, whatever it's trading at. A normal, reasonable person would assume, well, that's the price. That's what the going price is. That's what you got to pay. The fact that that same stock might be being offered at a better price on better terms to some people who know about the deal, but not to other people who don't know about the deal, frankly, seems to me like a huge injustice in the way the whole system is designed. I think it's a betrayal of the existing shareholders that even happens. But the thing is, if those are the rules and that's how it happens, if you want to buy Equinox and you can buy it for what it says on the screen, or you can get a much better deal if you're an accredited investor and you know which form to fill out, obviously you're going to do the latter. So for people who want to do this, there's a whole brokerage industry. They're called capital introduction brokers, people who introduce accredited investors to deals that are only offered to accredited investors. Tell us the ups and downs of that industry, Marin.
Sure. So whenever a company does a financing, they have to put a press release out. So everybody does have the same information at hand. The difference is do you know how to value that company versus what the value in the open market is? Just because, you know, you mentioned Equinox. When we were putting in hundreds of millions of dollars into the company, I'd been to the projects, I knew how to value it, and I could act quickly. So the average person has the same information as me. It's all public disclosure information, but are they able to piece it together and value it and move the capital quickly? Secondly is, you know, if a smaller company is doing a private placement, you can have a broker, but does that broker have a way into the management team who do the press release? Because generally speaking, a deal in a financing, you know, if they're going to raise $10 million, very rarely do they go and go, okay, we're going to do $10 million and we have no idea where we're going to get the money from. Please, we'll take money from you. They got a good idea. They have a broker involved, a banker involved. The banker is involved in setting the price, and he's got a good sense of where the appetite for the financing will be. Doesn't always happen that way. There's been many, many deals done by banks that get what's called hung, a financing that gets hung, meaning it doesn't get done. Now, the other aspects here are, you know, remember a broker, that's why they're called brokers. They're not called wealth creators or this or that. The average broker, Eric, does not have a degree in finance, does not have experience in it. It's like a 3-month online program to become a broker. They're glorified car salesmen. There's some great brokers out there, don't get me wrong. And people are going to hate me in the industry for saying this. But you know, when I got heart surgery, the surgeon spent years in school and years apprenticing and years as a surgeon. You want to follow someone who has years of direct experience, not someone who's just going to throw, oh, cannabis is hot, let's do these cannabis deal. Crypto's hot, let's do crypto. Because they're not investing their money. They're investing your money, and they take fees off of placing your money. They've already made money before you even get your shares from the company you're investing in. Those are the brokers and the investment bankers. So always, it's just so simple, Eric. Ask yourself this. Does this person have the same skin in the game ratio as me? do we win together or do we lose together? Or is he one up on me regardless of what happens to me? And generally, just stick to people whose interests are aligned with yours, you're at the same price as you, and just run with it. Doesn't mean it's always going to work. Not everything I do is a success. I've lost lots of money and lots of deals. But overall, the track record's been very impressive because I stick with financing deals as cheap as I can with management teams who are the largest shareholders in sectors that they have an advantage in, focusing on tier one assets in politically stable jurisdictions. It really is that simple, Eric. I don't need to take crazy risks. And if management's cost is a dollar and you're going to finance this at $10, even if they're great guys, they're 10 up on you. Why bother? So I don't.
Okay, let's talk through, for people who may not be familiar with it, how some of these deals work, because I really don't think they have parallels outside of the precious metals industry. The legal structures may be there, but I don't think they're frequently used. So I want to use, we used an example of Equinox a few minutes ago. There's another company that you organized a financing for more recently. Because I learned about that through your newsletter out of respect for your paying subscribers, I'm not going to mention the name of the company, but very similar company, I think, to Equinox when you first got involved with Equinox. It's not a startup. So the opportunity for me as an accredited investor is not to be an angel investor in a startup that's nowhere close to being public. It's a company that's already trading on a public stock exchange that I can see trading on a screen, you know, on an E-Trade quote in front of me. But the opportunity that's being offered to accredited investors is the opportunity to buy the stock at maybe a tiny little discount below what the market price is, but usually only a small discount. The thing is, it's not just the discount. You also get a half warrant, which is an option to buy more shares at a fixed price, but effectively a call option for free with the deal. So by buying through this mechanism as an accredited investor, you get basically, you know, buy one, get one free. You buy shares and you get free warrants just for exercising your privilege of being an accredited investor. That's the advantage of these structures. And there's two ways to get introduced to a deal like that. One is through a broker that makes a commission on introducing you to the deal. The way that you do this, Baron, is different. The way that you organize it is you're participating in these financings yourself. You organize them for your own benefit so that you can invest in them. And then you charge a fee for people who want to get your newsletter to know about the deal so they can invest alongside you. The way I look at it, honestly, is if I deal with a broker, I would be a complete fool not to do very thorough due diligence, because brokers cause somebody to go broke, usually not them, and I don't want it to be me. So if I invest with your deal, frankly, I ought to be doing my thorough due diligence anyway, but you know what? I usually don't. If you have more at risk, if more of Marin Katusa's money is going to be lost than Eric Townsend's money, if it turns out that you screwed up this deal, that's enough for me. That's your skin in the game proves to me that you wouldn't be selling this deal if you didn't believe in it, because you're going to lose more than I do. That seems like a better way to do this than paying the brokers a commission for it. Why doesn't everybody do it the way you do? And are there other people, financiers, who structure these deals the way you do, where it's basically pay me a fee to get, instead of the companies getting the middleman fee, it's pay me a fee to get my newsletter, and then I'll just tell you what I'm doing, and you can do it too, and there's no middleman fees after that. Why doesn't everybody do it that way?
Yeah, so the key part here is I do not have a private placement service. My newsletter, these are just things that I'm doing, and what the whole newsletter is about. We provide all the research, interviews, the site visits, interviews with the management team. And I'm going, look, I'm putting $10 million in. I've done it to organize my own investment. And then I tell the company, look, I have no idea if Eric Townsend is going to click the link, read the report, watch the video, and go, yeah, I like this idea with Marin, or I think Marin's smoking crack, and I think it's a stupid idea. I have no idea what an Eric Townsend's going to say. But if Eric likes it, he can contact the company and invest directly if he meets the criteria. In certain instances, you've got to be accredited, and other ones, it's not. Every deal is different. Then I say, hey, if they come in, there's no fees paid to anyone. Treat everyone the way you treat me, the way you treat my crew. And it's been a great experience. The reason why other companies can't do this. They have private placement services, which I do not, and all they offer is private placements. Now, Eric, like I said, I'll go 8 months without a deal, and because I'm looking to place my own money. But if I was forced, if Eric Townsend subscribed to my newsletter, because every month on Monday of the first month, I have to have a new deal, how good do you think the deals are going to be after a while if you're forced to find new deals? In addition, the big publishing companies don't allow their authors and analysts to own the stocks that they talk about. So right off the bat, they're forced to come up with deal flow. And number two, they're not allowed to buy it themselves. Even if they wanted to, they're not allowed. In the long term, how do you think that that's going to do when there's no skin in the game and it's all about volume? It's not going to do well. Secondly, a lot of publishing businesses are about rotating from hot sectors because they're in the business of selling subscriptions, newsletters. I do this to publish to get access to deal flow. Like, because I've published all this material, this deal that I'm doing now, these guys approached me a year ago, and it's about getting access to deal flow that I don't get to maybe meet these guys because they're on the other side of the world in Australia or wherever. And in today's world, if you publish or perish. So they know that I'm willing to write a big check and play in a big way. The alligators may or may not show up, but if they show up, they get treated the same as me at the same time, at the same price, and there's no fees. So it's a total advantage for everyone. It's gotten to the point where the biggest players at the brokerage firms are bypassing their own rules to participate in the financings that we structure. Individuals that you've had on your podcast play in big ways because for them, there's a rule for brokers. They have to give their clients deals first if it's brokered, and then they can't even get in their own deals. So a lot of the big deals, the good juicy ones, are done non-brokered by the brokers so they can do it themselves. I know it sounds screwed up, but that's how it goes. And think about it. Even if you're a publisher or not a publisher, if it was so good and you believed in it, wouldn't you put your own money in before you tell anyone else? It's such a simple strategy that it blows my mind that more people don't focus on this.
Well, I feel like we're missing something here, Marin, because if you look at the hedge fund industry, it is very, very standard. You got to eat your own cooking. The fund manager who has not invested a very significant percentage of his own personal net worth into his own fund so that his money is at risk, that guy doesn't get taken seriously. And you have to be willing to make that investment in order to have that job. I don't know anyone, and I hope there is someone other than you who structures it this way, but as far as I know, the capital introduction industry, and I don't mean just in precious metals, I mean for everything, for software, for whatever, it's entirely about middlemen who don't have skin in the game hooking deals up. And sometimes they hook up some really good deals. There are some capital introduction brokers who only work with very well-heeled people who do amazing things. But it seems to me that just as the hedge fund industry has learned that there's no substitute for skin in the game, what a benefit it is to me as an investor, Marin, that I can invest in one of your deals and I can reduce the amount of my time and energy that is necessary for due diligence by whatever amount of trust I'm willing to put in the fact that I know you're going to lose more than I am if we lose. And frankly, that goes a long way with me. It saves me a lot of time and energy. I would like to invest in a whole bunch of decentralized finance software deals in the same structure that I get somebody who I think knows more about that industry than I do, who wants to tell me what their deals are, and I'll pay them a fee in order to do what they're doing because I don't have time to research it myself. I don't know where to find that. I know where to find an army of cap intro salesmen who want to introduce me to the next complete, total, pain in the ass, waste of time, DeFi idiot scheme that none of them have any idea what they're doing. Because it's just, you know, life's too short to spend trying to find those gems. So why doesn't the entire capital introduction industry, why doesn't the buy side just insist on only dealing with people who have skin in the game? I don't get it.
Well, look, like I think a lot of it comes down to just volume. You know, if you're a broker, you can't survive. If you're an investment bank, take any of them. I don't care which one. I'm agnostic. To me, they're all the same. You can't survive if you're doing two or three deals a year. I can, Eric. To me, it's irrelevant. I put my time in. I have a whole staff, geologist engineers that I pay for, but I position myself that, you know, I take a big swing personally on these after it meets my criteria. There's guys that you know and admire in the mining world that I've done the due diligence on their projects, gone to site, signed CAs, and I passed on the deal and I don't talk about it, right? No big deal. But there's so many deals that I go through and find something like fluorine in the concentrate that I know the smelters are going to do a massive discount on that no analyst has picked up. Or for example, in my book, I have a chapter about, wait a second, I have not read a single research report in the world, in the resources, where any analyst in the NPV and the future cash flow valuations has incorporated the future carbon cost that is coming. And it's going to be put onto their balance sheet as a liability. But because I'm putting huge amounts of my personal net worth, my children's money, I don't do this for the money. Like, money is obviously the score and all that. But if I stop, I'm done. Like, I've had a great career. But I protect this money. It's my children's and my wife's. After I'm long gone, I'm protecting what I've built. And you have to model this stuff. And because this is my money and I'm the lead order, and whether people come with me or not, it's irrelevant to me because I'm doing it myself. I need to calculate these things that I'm not going to rely on an analyst who makes 110 grand a year. He doesn't give a shit. He's analyzing 50 deals. He physically cannot do this because they're in the business of trying to give, you know, 1 inch high, a mile wide research. But the depth, they just physically can't do that. They can't, like, Eric, I booked a private plane last summer during the quarantine on a deal that you invested in and many of your viewers. I put up the cash for that. I put up the cost of my team for months of research. I'd be out of the hole 300 grand if it didn't work out. And that's the cost of business. On top of that, I was away from my family for a week in the summer. And when I got home, I had to be away from them for 2 weeks. That's psychologically hard to be away from your family for 3 weeks in summer, right? Like, you want a happy wife, that's not the way you do it. With the hope of, don't worry, babe, if this works out, we're going to make lots of money. After a while, she's tired of hearing that, right? My point is no firm can succeed by doing that model because they need deal flow and finder fees to keep the business going, right? I don't need that.
So you're basically saying that your own business model is not scalable beyond a one-man show.
It can't be. Well, it's not a one-man show. Like, we're a big shop. We're, you know, just to put it in perspective, I do more financings than all the other banks in the business in Canada combined. Think about that for a second now. You take all the brokerage firms in the commodity sector, add them all up, and the financings that I do are bigger than all of them combined versus a guy that's just doing his own thing with his team. And I've got a great team. So that's what I mean. The brokerage firms can't do that because they have hundreds of brokers. And if they only had three deals, they wouldn't have the business.
Okay, Maren. So big picture, the way this industry finances itself relies on the participation extensively of accredited investors who are sometimes able to buy shares and warrants on better terms than they're offered for on the public market. And it's very important if you're an accredited investor, obviously, to benefit from that. The ways of doing that are either to deal with a middleman or to deal with someone like yourself who's doing it as a newsletter. You're actually kind of a special one-off case. Let's talk about, regardless of whether it was brokered or you're doing it, let's talk about the structure of one of these deals. And how about if we use an example from something you're actually working on?
So tomorrow, all the alligators, today's what, May, June 1st. On June 2nd, I'm publishing on a deal that, you know, has been a year in the works, lots of due diligence, lots of phone calls, me doing my thing, and the company is raising a big amount of capital. Bankers, Goldman Sachs was there, the biggest banks in the business were there. But there's a pandemic going. And as I'm asking all these questions, when's the road tour? They're, well, you know, we can't leave. We don't know how we're going to do this. The bankers were all kind of stuck. And public information, I used all the publicly available data on their website. I crunched my numbers. And this is what I did. After spending many, many months doing this, I took a 50% discount to the commodity price at spot. Then I took a 40% discount to its free cash flow. And then I put a 12% discount on the NPV, okay? And I said, all right, I'll tell you what. I'll put up $10 million US dollars, but I also want a CATUSA warrant. And, you know, management were up in arms going, are you crazy? It's worth three times more, blah, 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 blah. I said, okay, well, what are the bankers offering you? And he came back and said, the bankers haven't offered me anything. We have to do a roadshow. When? I don't know. Oh, who are you going to meet? I don't know. What price? I don't know. It's going to be assessed after the roadshow. And I go, but you have a window to acquire something here that you've already told the bankers you need, but they can't give you anything firm. I'm just willing to give you 10 million US guaranteed personal check right now on these terms, but I'm going to put an alert out. If my subscribers want some and they're accredited and they meet the criteria after reading it and they want to go directly to you, make sure you treat them the way you treat Marin Katusa. And they said, you know, they had their board meeting. They went back and they said, you know what? We think you're getting a great deal. And I said, great. Why don't you guys invest a big chunk of your own money? So they are. So I got the skin in the game from the management. They're going to be the big investors. I'll be probably the largest individual shareholder of this company. My subscribers get a chance to come in. And the way the way it trades in the open market, since the deal was agreed on the price protection, it's trading at multiples of what the financing's at. And it trades. So what I'm trying to get at is, I was there, I did my homework, I stepped up like an alligator, I gave them a firm offer, and it doesn't matter which financing, even if the bankers went around, whoever writes the biggest check dictates the terms. And that's how this deal happened.
So essentially what you're doing is you're saying to the company that's talking to the bankers and brokers and so forth, they're getting ready to go do the roadshow, try to raise some money. And you're saying, look, I would like to tell you that my name is Marin Katusa and I am such a big fat cat that I've got enough money that I can do your whole deal myself, just one guy. But since I'm not quite that big of a fat cat, what I do have is friends and friends with money that listen to me. And if you want to do a deal right here, right now, we can close the deal today, or you can spend the next 6 months on a road trip screwing around with the investment bankers and hopefully get a deal. And you're better off to just do the deal with me. You, Marin Katusa, are not rich enough to do those deals with those companies as one individual because you don't have enough money to finance these things all by yourself. But with your subscribers, you can do that. So that's basically your business model. As you figure the deal out, your subscribers get the same deal as you do. What you get from your subscribers is two things. One, they pay you a pretty darn generous subscription fee for getting the newsletter in the first place. And number two, they make you effectively have more purchasing power than you would have had otherwise. So you can do deals single-handedly that normally only an investment bank could pull off. Is that basically the gist of it?
Exactly. And on top of that, the company doesn't have to pay massive banker fees, you know, up to 20% of the capital raised stays in the company.
Okay. Well, this model works for me personally, resonates for me. I do want to do a good job for our listeners, though, and make sure that we explain. Look, there's another way of doing this. You can get access to a larger selection of deal opportunities, a much larger selection than Marin offers, by working with a private placement capital introduction broker. They can introduce you to far more deals, many, many more deals than Marin will ever offer you. They're middlemen, and Marin's got his own skin in the game. I prefer to work with your business approach, but it's only because I'm lazy. You know, I would actually rather broaden my horizons and consider the deals the brokers are offering in addition to your deals, Marin, if I had the time to go do the due diligence that's necessary in order to do that. But I don't. So that's how I approach it. Let's talk about the benefits. How much of a difference does this make? You know, suppose you've got an investor who could just, you know, read a newsletter like yours and invest in the public market in stocks. How much of a difference does this whole access to private placements and financings make for investors compared to doing it on the public markets?
So these are all large deals that I'm doing. I don't do early stage. I don't do, you know, a 20 million market cap or 50 million. Like, these are very big companies that have big cash flow. Even, you know, Eric, even though a company may be $1 billion market cap or a $2 billion market cap, if I personally wanted to invest 10 million in the market, which is like my starting ticket for these deals, I can't do it in even 2 weeks. My broker has to sit there. There's the bid ask. I got to deal with a broker, which I generally don't like doing to begin with. I got to pay them a fee. You know, there's just a transaction fee that you have to pay brokers. And I don't get a warrant in the market. Now, by doing a financing, yeah, I've spent a lot of time on this, but I do that anyways. Before I go into the open market, I get a discount to the market. I'm able to allocate my first and second tranche if I want, and one check in one transaction. And I get the CATUSA warrant, which, you know, you look at the numbers, there's a reason why I have the number one track record for many years in the sector. And it's why my competitors, I'm their go-to guy for this stuff. They don't talk about that publicly, but these are all my buddies that I've known for 15, 20 years, and I don't care. I just want to make sure that I get my money and my family's money into the best deals. And you nailed it. You know, in the resource junior world, I've kind of outgrown the juniors. So I'm in that mid-tier and big caps. And I don't have enough capital to do this on my own. And I don't want to go and create a new hedge fund and deal with all that stuff. So I said, screw it. I've got the reputation. I've got the KRO alligators, the newsletter subscribers. I've got the most powerful and best subscribers in the world in finance. And they read my stuff. And it's up to them if they want to participate. It is the best model I can think of to participate in the commodity sector.
Well, it has certainly worked for me. I am up significantly, and I mean 500%, I think, on one of the deals that I've done with you, and the others are all up as well. So it works for me. I want to move on, though, to another subject, which is, in addition to that business, you're also a best-selling author. What's up all of a sudden with the new book? Why the new book? What's it about? What's going on?
So I started it last year, and my first book was a result of my heart surgery, so I had to stay home by doctor's order, so I wrote a book. I guess you can call me a busybody. After I was in quarantine last year for 2 weeks away from my family, I couldn't go into the office. I thought, you know, I'm writing a lot of interesting things. When I had my swap line concept and all these different unique ideas on the resource sector, and I had guys like Tom Kaplan, some of the smartest, successful resource guys, reach out to me and want to pick my brain on these ideas. And I had guys like Rich Dad, Poor Dad call me, get my number from people that I, you know, don't even know how they got my number, and pick my brain. And when, you know, a guy like Tom Kaplan or, you know, Robert Kiyosaki are saying, hey, you need to really write a book about this. And you're like, ah, whatever. And I've been there, done that, went through the whole dog and pony show of book tours and all that. And, ironically, one of the guys that I worked with on my first book started reading my stuff and said, there's a book here. And I said, ah, come on. And then I was toying around with the guys in the office and I said, you know, I think this anti-American, you know, America's at its absolute low for trust in government, absolute low in trust in media, the political division. You look at the commentary and the momentum on the US dollar, the belief in the resource sector and the gold sector, which I'm a big player in, on the anti-American movement, the US dollar's trash. It's all about China, this G2 argument. And I said, you know, I've got an interesting idea, and it just hit me, the rise of America. So I went on GoDaddy.com and I went, geez, I wonder who owns that URL and how much does it cost? It was available, Eric. And I bought it for $1.99. And then I bought the .ca and .com, all the different URLs. And I went, this is a really contrarian indicator that riseofamerica.com is available for 10 bucks in every country that I have, you know, that I want to have the URL in. And as I started digging into the data, I got more and more convinced, and I know it's a contrarian idea, and I'm not trying to be contrarian for the sake of contrarian. And Eric, after it hit number one, the amount of abuse I've been getting from the gold bugs and the resource sector investors who know me, thinking, what the hell has Marin become, a tree hugger, and what, he's joined the new world order. And I'm like, oh my God, you know, it's math, it's data, it's follow the money, look at the sectors. And I present a very unique take. It's about twice as long as my first book, Eric. It's over 450 pages. And I start with, how did we get to where we are? And, you know, everyone's talking about MMT, and I'm saying, no, you got to look at the present. You know, a lot of people, what's the name of the Federal Reserve building? Eccles Building. Who is Eccles? He's got a cool name, Mariner. You know, anyone with a name with Mariner, I'm going to pay attention to. And he truly was the most powerful Federal Reserve in America's history. Yet the average person who talks about MMT or, you know, the anti-US movement or the Fed is dead and all these stupid things against the Fed have no idea who this guy is or what FMC is, fiscal monetary coordination. He was the most powerful guy in the Fed for 40 years. They named the building after him and he brought in FMC. Then you look at where we are today. We're not at MMT yet. Everyone thinks we are. We're at FMC and it's going to happen much more. If you think that the, you know, printing press, as people say, how could it get any worse? You haven't seen anything yet. They're going to print much, much more. And the attacks that I'm getting on the book tell me that people are not keeping this in a relative basis. When you compare the US to Japan or Canada or the EU or China, you'll realize that America has much more running room than anyone's giving it credit for. That's just on the fiscal and monetary aspect. Then you look at the pools of capital. You look at the cost of electricity. You look at all these different factors that are going to really reinvigorate the American green industrial revolution. I'm not just talking green energy. I'm talking about cost of energy, cost of capital. America has a lot going for it. And you know, I'm not saying that China is going to go to zero. I'm saying that the rise of America will rise the rest of the world, including China. Okay. And there's a lot that the book, there's a lot of myths. I break down, why is 2% the Fed's inflation target? I break down the history of that. A lot of people just say there's a 2% target. No one asks why. So really what I broke down is after many, many bottles of wine late night, I'm not allowed to go anywhere. My family's in bed. I don't sleep much. And it's 8 months of staying up till 2 o'clock at night, just researching, reading, and entertaining myself. So the real summation is the last chapter called The Forbidden Chapter. And every chapter builds upon the framework that I have for The Forbidden Chapter and where I think things are going. So that's kind of how it happened, why it happened. Did I think it was going to be a number one bestseller? I did not, Eric. We haven't spent a dollar in marketing yet on it at all. My publisher had the number one bestseller with David Goggin before that. We've beat him now. The publisher is surprised. And I guess I'm not the easiest guy to work with because they had a lot of suggestions and I said no. They didn't want it 450 pages. I said too bad because I put in the contract that it's my terms in what I wanted in the book. So that's why I did it. And it's my last book. And then I think it's the framework where I'm betting a lot of money on.
Well, I'm reading it now, quite enjoying it, and looking forward to the Forbidden Chapter, which I haven't gotten to. But I've got to be honest, I'm actually a bigger fan of a different publication, which is your newsletter. In the interest of full disclosure, I am a subscriber to the newsletter. I am a participant in several of your deals, so I do have my own vested skin in the game and some of your offerings. But please tell us a little bit more. Frankly, the newsletter's not cheap. This is not for the retail investor who's a newbie who's got a financial net worth of $10,000. Who is it for, and how much does it cost normally, and how much of a discount did we manage to talk you into this time for Macro Voices listeners?
The newsletter is $3,500 US a year. I have no idea what the discount is with Suede. I think you guys probably did $2,500, I'm assuming. It really is for the people who want to educate themselves and have actionable advice. If you don't want to invest into this sector and educate yourself, think of this as a very expensive private trainer that you want to get very fit. There's absolutely no point of buying this product if you don't want to invest the time to read it. And my reports are not narratives and, you know, catchy stories to sell a newsletter. That's the opposite. It gets into cash flow models. I get into, you know, real deep financial analysis on the sector using my own indicators, the math background that I have. Is it the most entertaining read? Probably not. I believe it's the most informative read where other brokerage firms use my data and charts in their reports. But this is not something that you read passively. It's for the person that wants to expose their portfolio to the sector. And, you know, the average length of a report is about 40 to 50 pages every month of hardcore data. So that's who it's for, Eric.
Maren, I hope you won't be offended at my saying it, but frankly, it's overpriced for small investors. If you don't have at least $50,000 or so that you want to invest in the resources sector, in my opinion, something like this, it's not that it's not a good value, but it's just beyond a reasonable price range for that kind of investor. For accredited investors, I can't speak highly enough about it. We're going to have to leave it there in the interest of time. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. Monetary and fiscal measures by governments and central banks are inflating asset prices globally. As investors prepare for future inflation, demand for scarce real assets is rising. How does the 1% prepare for this? They invest in art. Masterworks.io is the first company that lets you invest in multi-million dollar paintings at a fraction of the cost from artists like Basquiat and Keith Haring. 84% of ultra-high net worth individuals collect art, according to a 2019 Deloitte survey. And it makes sense. According to Citi Private Bank, contemporary art returned 13.6% year over year in the last 25 years versus 8.9% for the S&P 500. Over the same period, art had the lowest correlation to the stock market of the 10 major asset classes. Masterworks.io is making art investing accessible to everyone, regardless of accreditation. Start diversifying your net worth today. Visit Masterworks.io to learn more. See important information at Masterworks.io/disclaimer.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Maren back on the show. What did you take away from the interview?
Well, I really think that Maren has the right business model. I think that other capital introduction people should do it the way Maren does, which is, you know, show your own skin in the game. And it works for me. Frankly, the reason that I favor him, it's not that I don't like the brokers that offer these deals. The reason that I do these deals with Maren is because I know he's done the due diligence, because he always has more of his own money to lose than I have of my money. And frankly, you know, he just turned around one deal in a private placement that returned 350% in a year, another deal that's up 15%. So every deal that I've done with him, Patrick, I've been entirely happy with. I can't get him out of salesman mode sometimes, but other than that, the guy's a moneymaker. In any event, Patrick, let's move on to talking charts in a chart deck that you have titled, wait for it, Talking Charts. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, you can just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, click the red button that says looking for the downloads. Patrick, chart two here, S&P 500 continuous chart, and you got it, the gamma trampoline on the bottom.
Right. And so on the S&P 500 chart, I mean, the observation that has to be made is that we remain in bull trend. That 50-day moving average that is there has contained all the price action in that bullish upwards trajectory. But the one interesting part here is that the S&P is struggling to make 52-week highs. And the question really is that what will be the tailwind to drive higher prices? And that's where I want to take the conversation next few charts. But before we move on, I did want to highlight the gamma profile going in here to the tail end of the June expiry. And what we have is currently the gamma flip level lies about 41.68. Those are numbers provided by Spot Gamma, Brent over there. And the interesting part is that the last time we had that gamma flip, that was where we had a big spike in volatility. And today's lows, intraday lows, came in right around that level. So we're at an interesting moment where the market hasn't been willing to break out to new highs. And yet right below us lies the levels where we could see some volatility return. And so it'd be really interesting to see which way this market breaks in the coming while. My intuition as to which way it goes actually is a slightly bearish tilt to it. And I'll explain why here on the second chart. On page three, we have the chart of the NASDAQ. And one of the things that is a part of my thesis right here is the fact that I don't believe that the market can make its next kind of 5% advance, a 200-300 S&P point advance higher without proper participation of the NASDAQ and the FANG stocks. The financials and the cyclicals have done so well for the markets and have been really where the leadership has been. But one of the interesting things is the NASDAQ is dogging it. When looking at this chart, it has failed to retest their highs, incredibly heavy, rolling over, and it gets worse if you look on page 4 when you actually target the actual FANG stocks. And you can observe that on the FANG stocks, the rally was just outright weak. And when you go to some of the individual components like Apple, Microsoft, and Amazon, they simply can't get any traction, or Tesla or Netflix. And we really are seeing these big market cap behemoths that simply can't get out of their own way. And the question really is can the S&P break out and make that next advance without this one important, very market cap heavy sector participating? And I personally feel that this is something that is actually giving some bearish tones to the marketplace, even though the S&P chart on the surface looks quite bullish.
Patrick, let's take a look at volatility in the stock market with the VIX on page 5. And boy, you know, we're just coming off of what seems like, is that a multi-year low?
No, I mean, it's the post-COVID lows.
It's been more than a year now, buddy.
It's been more than a year. But I think the observation that I wanted to point out here along that key support line is that when we had that May spike in volatility that saw us shoot up towards 28 to 30 on the upside was the last time we had that gamma flip. So when we talked about it on the S&P chart on page 2, just really trying to identify what could arise if we just had any 50 to 100 S&P point correction kick in, it would certainly potentially have another proper spike of volatility into the mid-20s at minimum. And this is why it's such a critical moment, because the contracting volatility has actually been an important tailwind to the market up until now. Nonetheless, I wanted to move on to page 6 and just show that breakout candle on the dollar index that we talked about in the market wrap. And while one day never makes a new trend, and it's certainly we've had two false start breakouts on the dollar in the last couple of weeks, and each time the sellers came back pretty quickly and the price action has been relatively weak. But I think that the support line that the multi-year support line on the dollar index we talked about even last week, I think on first test will hold. And so it would be very natural for the dollar index to bounce back toward 91 to 92. But the jury will still be out even on a rally like that, whether that's enough to change the predominant bearish trend that's been so dominant for all of the last 6-7 months.
Well, Patrick, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Frankly, I think that the more that I hear of the bearish trend that's been dominant, what I hear is a lot of bearish rhetoric coming out of people who, in a lot of cases, are making arguments for why they think the currency should be weak on an absolute basis, but they're making a forecast that has to do with its outlook on a relative basis, relative to other currencies. And although I think the absolute outlook for the dollar is horribly bearish, I think it's completely jury's out on whether it's up or down for the dollar relative to the other currencies. It's a competition between central bankers, and we don't know how it's going to play out yet. In any event, let's move on to crude oil, my favorite subject, on page 7.
Right. And this is where I wanted to just kind of observe some things beyond the fact that crude oil is breaking to a fresh high. So we clearly have a technical breakout to that 52-week high. And crude oil looks like at this point moving to $70 to $72 in the next week or two. It would be a very natural thing to occur. But what I find particularly interesting is if we go to page 9 and look at gasoline futures, we have not seen gasoline futures break to higher highs. And often we see the correlation between the two. Now, that doesn't have to always be the case. I mean, that's why crack spreads widen and narrow. But it'll be really interesting to see whether other markets like this start to confirm the oil breakout or not. And this hasn't happened yet. Another really interesting thing about the crude oil breakout is that we're not really seeing it move the entire term structure. And this is where I wanted you to come in and give us some more context context on this, but we continue to see all the longer dated crude oil contracts still trading in the mid 50s. And it really continues to just be a steepening of the backwardation in this curve that is being driven here. I mean, how steep can this curve get in your mind, Eric?
It can get steeper in my mind. We do have finally the Z1, Z2 spread, that is, or what some people call Dece-Red-Dece, the difference between the price of crude oil that is delivered in December of 21 and December of 22. The difference between those prices is back over $5 this week. It had been trading below that for the last couple of weeks in this consolidation. We're back above that. I think it goes considerably higher. Now, there have been times when the crude oil market has really seen substantial backwardation because usually of geopolitical stresses, where you get a difference between months where the average is more than a dollar per month. So in other words, it would be $12 of difference between December of 1 year and December of the next year if the average difference is $1 per month of price. Right now, it's less than 50 cents on average. It's running less than $6. I do think it has further to go, and I don't think that there is any reason to interpret the back of the curve prices not coming up as being bearish. The fact that the term structure is steepening is a sign of increasing bullishness in terms of market participants and outlook. I expect the steepness of the term structure to continue to steepen as we continue to move on into next year. And I think it potentially gets dramatically steeper between 2022 and 2024, if a number of things all happen to line up the way I think they might. It's too early to call that one yet. But as far as right now, I do think it gets steeper from here, and I don't think we're done yet.
What do you think would be the circumstances for us to see the entire term structure level rise like a tide coming in where we see, you know, $60 or something at the belly of the curve?
Well, Patrick, I can't help but wonder why you're asking that question or what insight you think is revealed by answering that question. I mean, unless you actually want to make plans to take delivery of crude oil yourself 10 years from now and you want to lock in your price right now, we're looking at this in terms of what does it mean for the front month. And I don't think that what happens in those back month prices really tells you very much. The back month prices really are a product of market expectations that lead to certain amounts of backwardation or contango, and then they're all anchored to the front of the curve where the price discovery occurs on the front month contract. So, Patrick, as far as what happens to the price of crude oil in 2027, it matters from the perspective of analyzing the shape of the term structure, but I don't think that absolute number is meaningful in the way that you're alluding to. But, Patrick, going back to page 7, I want to ask your opinion, because you are the resident technician. Look at this chart. Obviously, something big changed in November. That was the beginning of an epic rally that took us through the beginning of March. Then we consolidated for a couple of months, and now we're breaking out. How do you think about this chart as a technician in terms of trying to choose a target for where the market might be headed? I mentioned a simple measured move technique that I've applied. You're the better technician. What techniques would you apply? How would you set price targets for where this rally might ultimately top out?
Well, I think the shorter target lies in the 70-72, but that's like something that could be achieved within a week on the upside. But if this is a legitimate bull breakout on that, then definitely the targets all lie in that kind of $80 to $90 range on the upside. I think the most important thing when you get a breakout like this is to actually see whether the bulls can hold it. And what often is a bearish sign is if we saw the entire breakout given back in its entirety and more, and we go back to trading, down into the mid 60s. If we saw that, then that would put a kind of a big damper on this breakout. So really, I think going into next week, you want to see whether or not the bulls keep the price action bullishly advancing. Lots of confirmation from other markets. I want to see the energy stocks also starting to participate with more velocity. And if we see that kind of price action, then your targets up into the toward 90 are all achievable if they can keep building the momentum on us.
Let's move on to page 10 and lumber futures. Boy, what an interesting chart. We've kind of got a, looks like a blow-off top and then an echo blow-off top.
Right. And so one of the key things that I was watching, obviously, we came in with a pretty significant short-term parabolic blow-off on the upside back at the start of May. And we saw the lumber futures give back close to $500 off their peak highs on the downside. But when we got that reversal approaching 1500, that was actually a very important moment to see whether or not the bulls had enough gas in the tank to make another run towards all-time highs. And the fact that we failed and have more or less been very distributive in the price action, there's an increasing chance that we have seen peak lumber on this intermediate high level. And it's entirely possible that we're going to see it work its way down toward 1,000 on the downside. And it's not a crazy thought to go back to 1,000, because if you go back and look at several years, even a decade of price action on lumber, we have not seen 1,000 until this breakout. And so for us to actually consolidate down to and stay above 1,000 would still, in the much, much bigger picture, be bullish for lumber. But it's simply at this stage, that short-term high is now leading to this distribution cycle. And that's where on page 11, we have that lumber term structure. And again, we're in a similar situation in terms of backwardation, the way you were describing it in the oil market as well, which is that front month lumber contract is trading up there in the 1300 plus level. But almost all of the contracts in November and farther out are all trading at 1,000 or less. And really kind of goes to show that this entire lumber surge may very much have been, dare I say the word, transitory in terms of short-term demand versus the supply that was available. And maybe we'll see a bit more of a normalization in lumber prices in the next half a year or so.
Patrick, what do you make of the very sharp turn down in gold? And of course, it was commensurate with a turn up in the dollar index. Some people, I'm sure, are saying, that's it. The gold market's going to crash from here. I don't think so. What do you think?
Well, I think that gold, after that really solid two-month run, needed to have a point where the rally was checked and just to wash out the weak hands that were chasing this market higher. But what's interesting is that much of the entire consolidation of gold that happened over the 6 months prior to the breakout saw the price action trading below all of its moving averages. And so what's interesting is that this correction lines up where a 50% retracement comes for a test right into the moving averages and its December lows. And so I think that a pullback in gold towards 1800 would be actually quite natural, but the real tell will be whether the bulls buy the dip and hold the line in those support lines. If we see another, you know, $50 on the downside of gold and the buy and dip traders solidly defend it and reverse it off those levels, that actually would only reinforce the fact that gold has shifted into a new bull phase.
Patrick, I just want to clarify what you said about the $1,800 level as the 200-day moving average. My chart has the 200-day moving average around 1850 and has the 100-day moving average at 1800. Are we talking about the same 200-day moving average?
Right. Thanks for bringing that, because we have to clarify that. You're looking at the simple moving averages, which is actually quite commonly used. It's not wrong, but in this particular case, I have the 50 and the 200-day exponential moving averages, which are just trading at a different level. And so it is, I guess, important to observe where that simple moving average is in there. But the support line that I was talking about, where the 50% retracement, Fibonacci retracement level is all around that 1800. Level.
Well, that makes perfect sense. And of course, listeners, for any of you who want to be on top of this stuff and know the difference between an exponential moving average and a simple one, check out page 13 of the chart deck, where you can sign up for a free trial of Patrick's service, Big Picture Trading, and learn all about it with Patrick's chart decks every single day of the week. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Masterworks.io, bringing fine art investing within reach of all investors. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book that we just discussed in the postgame. There's also a link to a ChartPoint article titled Bulls and Bears, and a link to an article discussing militant ESG on oil will trigger consequences elsewhere. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, that's Eric spelt with a K, and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.